This is Developer Stories, where we ask you why you built it, and we look behind the scenes of some of tech's passion projects and people. Welcome to the show. You're in the right place.
Welcome to Developer Stories. Today, I'm joined by Michaela Taufer, Dungar Professor in High Performance Computing at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. Michaela is director of the Global Computing Laboratory and active in so many of our HPC conferences, and we're so happy to have her on the show today. Michaela, welcome.
Thank you, Vanessa. Thank you for inviting me to join this conversation.
So Michaela, I would like to talk a lot about high performance computing and leading a lab, but first I want to hear about your background. Can you take us back to your training as early as you'd like to go? And tell us the story of how you went from student to where you are today.
Oh my goodness, that is a long story.
We got time, we got time.
Well, I have a technical degree in high school in informatic, they call that. And then I went to the University of Padua for my, it's called a laurea, or it was called a laurea once upon a time, which is probably equivalent to a bachelor in computer engineering. Guess what? I left home convinced that I was going and enroll in biology, and I came back enrolled in computer engineering. So then I decided at the last moment just to go to engineering rather than biology. I'm sorry for the biology community, or perhaps they are saved now. Said that, I had my bachelor/laurea in computer engineering, and I decided at the end of my 5 years, we have to have a senior thesis, and I decided to travel across Europe and to part of what is called an Erasmus program. It's very popular in Europe. Students can travel across states, university. They normally do that for a semester or 1 year to take classes or to do the senior thesis. And so I was supposed to go to Aberdeen to study AI, but at that time, AI was boring, probably something has happened in between. And so I ended up to go to the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, or ETH, where I pursue I worked with Walter Gander on the parallelization on a code for energy minimization in molecular structure. And there started my career as a HPC engineer / researcher with a passion for applications. And so I had my PhD at the ETH. I worked with other colleagues in molecular dynamics and volunteer computing. Then I moved to the state for 1 year for a postdoc. And guess what? I never went back. My postdoc was actually 2 years I was at the University of California, San Diego / the Scripps Research Institute, working in an interdisciplinary program that allowed me to work with fantastic colleagues in molecular dynamics at the Scripps Research Institute. And then I was supposed to go and work for Novartis, but I didn't. I moved to the University of Texas, El Paso, and I started my academic career, which is still in progress. So I was at University of Texas, El Paso, then I went to University of Delaware, and here I am at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. Long story short.
Awesome. Okay, I have a lot of questions. So let's go back first to the beginning. You decided, you said kind of at the last minute, to go into computing instead of biology. And I'm kind of thinking that myself and a lot of our listeners had these moments where we were deciding between these two very different paths. And so I'm wondering, do you remember the thought or decision process that drove that kind of quick change?
I'm a computer scientist, but my passion is in applied computer science. And I really was fascinated by this idea of delivering something to the community. And I thought the biology component was to study aspect of diseases, aspect of experiment in the lab, and then deliver eventually something to the community. And during this trip to the University of Padua, where I registered and back, I found out that there was a new program in computer engineering, and that possibility could have opened an opportunity for me not only to work with biologists, but with other scientists. And so I felt like, why doing once when I can do many or help many? And so I decided to move field and went to computer engineering.
That makes total sense. It sounds like you realize that you could have more impact from that view of a career as opposed to kind of, I'm imagining like a tree, like a graph. And either
Yes.
you're going to kind of jump into one of the lower level nodes, and then, the higher nodes are the ones that are having impact over the smaller subtree. And you realize that you were making a decision about where to operate in that tree, and you decided to go to a higher level of node.
At the root of the tree.
Yeah,
And
the root, the very root, the beginning of the universe. No, I'm just kidding. That's not the root.
that is indeed a good interpretation. Because it's never boring. You can learn about biology, you can learn about chemistry, you can learn about astrophysics. It's so diverse, it's never boring.
I totally agree. I totally feel that. Okay, so I have to ask about this question because AI and ML is like all the thing now. And probably most folks know that are not super young in their career that we sort of get AI over the decades in waves. And so I have to ask you about your point when you said that in your training, AI was boring. So I think I have a sense of what AI was back then, but can you tell our listeners, give us a brief description of what AI meant back then, and what made it so boring?
Well, it was very theoretical, and I'm not a theoretical, I'm a very pragmatical person. And it was very theoretical because computer system and HPC was not helping AI yet. And so when I have to choose between computer system, which was the topic of my PhD, and AI, and I decided to go to the ETH, I felt that I didn't want to close myself in a room and do theory. I want to really to have an aspect of applicability. And yes, I know, perhaps if I know now what I didn't know at that time, well, vice versa, if I knew at that time what I know now, perhaps it would have been a different choice, but I should have put on hold creativity and a lot of other things for many, many years. Well, I feel actually that through my training, computer system and HPC, now I'm well equipped to help AI people. So, yes, I didn't do AI at that time, but now I have the knowledge and the tools that can help my colleague in AI. So, once again, I can explore a new domain and I can help a new group of colleagues. So, at the end, it was a win.
I also think that's a win. And to go back to our graph analogy, I probably at the time that link between the nodes for AI and kind of supercomputing and the applied part, they weren't established yet. So if you went into AI, you were going to be kind of sitting in a room, staring at the ceiling and talking about very theoretical stuff, which is okay. It's definitely some people's thing, but I also understand this desire to have very kind of practical impact. And so it sounds like the graph has come together. I mean, we know the graph has come together, right? Like, look at what's going on in the world right now. But it sounds like you made the right decision for yourself at the time.
Indeed.
I like that. I guess so. This is a random follow-up question, but sometimes it feels like well, assuming that you go down a traditional path of like starting a family and having kind of things that tie you down as you get older, there is a sense of kind of temporal and spatial freedom when you're younger in your career before you've kind of made a lot of roots and connections to places. And did you have that sense of freedom at the time?
I did. I still have it, Vanessa. I still have
Ah, that's the theory.
it. That is the strong point of being in academia or working in a national lab. That freedom never goes away. Well, we become a little bit older sometime, and it is harder to move, but With the research and the collaborations, the freedom is always there. So I still feel free.
Yeah, me as well. I think it's gotten better since kind of finishing with degrees because there's sort of less official rules and deadlines and that kind of thing. Okay, so your PhD, let's jump to a slightly different topic. Your PhD was called Inverting Middleware Performance Analysis of Layered Application Codes and High Performance Distributed Computing.
Oh
Can
my
you tell us I read that. I cheated. Can you tell us about this work and what you learned?
Well, it was inverted middleware. The idea was at that point, and together with my advisors, it was Thomas Stricker and Dan Reed on my committee. We were looking at the aspect of how middleware were used at that time, which was a middleware was indeed a sort of layer that allow application to use the hardware. But we thought that it was important to look at the inverted middleware and build such an inverted middleware in which the performance information, the program counters, that there were not so many at that time, should be projected and injected into the inverted middleware, and the middleware should drive the application to run efficiently. It looks something that nowadays is just normal, isn't it? We need to run application efficiently, especially in AI. But at that time, because the hardware was not so mature, we had so little view of what was happening in the hardware at the hardware level. So the program counter, you could create two program counter at the time. But so my inverted middleware was constantly snooping and spying and getting information and then projecting that information into the application to make that running efficiently. That was what I remember of my PhD. But you know, I was working on my PhD and I finished it, and I was already working on other applications. There is work that it didn't end up in my PhD that I was doing sort of for fun. And so I started working with volunteer computing and moving molecular dynamic simulation on volunteer computing when I was still a PhD student. And when I became a postdoc, it became the key part of my work. So it's there is always overlapping between what we are publishing, what we are doing, but at the same time, also what is the next step? What is the next question I want to answer? It's not compartmental. That is another exciting part of working in a research environment like academia or research labs.
Ah, that's another good piece of advice. The fact that you were working on something kind of on the side, kind of for fun, and that turned into sort of a real part of your work. Can you tell us more about some of these side fun projects that turned into like living theses?
Well, at that time, when I was finishing my PhD, there was a lot of discussion about using idle cycles of volunteer across the world for the good of the society. And one of the things that has been always very intriguing, not only for me, but for a large group of our community is using molecular dynamic for understanding drug design, for understanding the reason for a protein misfolding. So a lot of things that can be connected to molecular dynamic simulation, and the molecular dynamic simulation can help us to understand at the level of atomic level something that perhaps we cannot understand otherwise. And so the idea is that not everybody can have supercomputers. And at that time, it was even harder than now to have access to supercomputers. You have really the count and an amount of allocation that was so tiny. And so there has been this idea that was initially proposed by David Anderson at Berkeley of reaching out to volunteer and say, hey, your laptop is not used. Can we use it for a piece of molecular dynamics simulation? And at that time, there was the understanding that that could also be a way to engage community and democratize access to science, something that now looks again normal. We really want to engage community and democratize access to science. But it was starting, and that was very exciting. So when I moved to my postdoc position and I was working with the group of Charlie Brooks at the Scripps Research Institute, I started developing what has been called was called Predictor Atoll, and we were reaching out to volunteer across the world using a software that David Anderson was developing at Berkeley, Boeing. And there was not Zoom at that time, and there was no easy connection. And so I was on the normal phone with David at Berkeley, debugging software that he was developing so that it was working for my application. And that was such an exciting experience. Can you imagine? I just got my PhD. I moved from Europe to the States. And now I'm speaking with somebody that I find is revolutionizing the way in which we look at computing resources. And we are working together to develop something that can help understand the folding of protein.
Oh, that's
So,
awesome. Is
oh,
that related to folding at home?
it is, it's not a folding. Fold-It was developed by David Baker at the University of Washington, if I'm not wrong. But I take a little bit of credit. So with David Anderson help, I did the Predictor Atoll, which was part of a competition that is very popular. Every 2 years, they release in summer a set of sequence of amino acids. You need to use molecular dynamics, any algorithm, and resources to predict the folding of these proteins. And I took that as my goal, my mission. And we, with the support of the team of Charlie, we put together this application. We distributed it, and it was quite challenging because it was buggy. And then we put together a poster, and we went to this competition and present the results. And David came by, look at the poster, and he was already probably working on Fold-It, and Fold-It started immediately after. But it's sort of, you know, when you see the community converging, and you are not the only one doing that. There is many great people that you admire doing the same, and you feel, wow, I'm part of this. It's very exciting. And so that was how it started. And then I went on doing docking at home, and engaging people in understanding the process of protein and ligand docking for drug design. And from there, yeah, here I am.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I'm somewhat familiar with some of these things because my program was biomedical informatics, although I wasn't particularly in that area, but I can attest that work is so super cool. Okay, so you finished your PhD, you had this awesome experience during your postdoc. Now, the role that you are in now, you are leading a lab, which is awesome. But there's obviously many steps that one must take when, in the academic kind of hierarchy of getting there in order to reach that. Can you walk through how you went from, for example, postdoc into this role of leading a lab? Because it probably wasn't just one year, for example.
No. And you know, I went to interview to Novartis. And because I was doing drug modeling and molecular dynamic simulation. And at 5 o'clock, they told me, oh my goodness. They said, well, the interview is gone. We are done. It's over. Everybody go home at 5. And I say, what? You go home at 5? It's still in the middle of the day.
The day is young. Yeah, I feel that, Michaela. You know me. I feel that. The death is not late.
Yeah, and so the part that at the same time I sent my application to many university, and I got the possibility to interview in South Texas, El Paso, and there I met Pat Teller, and I found that her energy and passion for research was contagious, and I decided to join there and say to Novartis, no, thank you, and so. That started my academic career, but it is a long process full of challenges, rejections, and meeting people, convincing students to stay in graduate school, recruiting postdoctoral researcher who get better offer from industry. It's a steep, steep path, but it's also very rewarding at the end. So yeah, I decided to stay in academia and I feel comfortable.
When you were a student and you were making that choice, and I bring this up because this is such a hard choice for so many people of going into industry versus going into academia, how did you decide?
Well, you know, in my group, we were three PhD students. My PhD advisor, Thomas Stricke, had three students, me, another two colleagues, Christian and Felix. And they went to Google at that time. And that was the right time to go to Google, to be frank, because it was a little bit earlier. But I
Is now
felt
the
that.
wrong time?
Well, I at that time I wanted to change the world, and I felt that by going to Google I would have not. Guess what? Perhaps somebody can disagree with me right now, but I felt like no, I have energy. I want to change the world, and again I wanted the freedom to decide what I wanted to do, and I felt that when I had my postdoctoral research experience and I was asked, well, what do you want to do? What is the next step? What do you think we should invest in? I thought, well, these are great questions that give me the freedom to answer and define my future. So that was really powerful.
So along that same trajectory, how have your technical interests changed and evolved?
Well, I still work with molecular dynamic simulations, but I have broadened my interest because, as I said, I was and I am. And I think I will. I'm interested in science and engineering in a broader spectrum. And so I've been working with people in seismology, I've been working with people in all sciences, hydrology. So I have been able to expand my network, my branches of my tree that you were making the comparison are now expanding. You know, it's not just understanding molecules, it's understanding new things. And so it allows me to learn new things and explore new things in different domain. But the part that also is left is this interest in computer systems. You know, HPC is a part of that, but in general, it's about the interest in computer system. How do they work and how do they have to work for scientific discovery? And that is the core. And then their applicability to the scientific discovery is the passion.
That makes total sense. So one more question about this trajectory. You are in a unique role because you lead a lab. So arguably you can kind of go up, you can progress in your career and you can become a very senior technical person, but decide that you don't want to have that role where you're overseeing an entire group of people. Plus, you know, the additional kind of work that comes with that. How did you decide that that's what you wanted to do?
It came natural, Manisa. It's not that I decided it. It's something that came very natural. It came with putting a little bit of passion, putting all the curiosity. But it's not that I really said, okay, I want to have that group. Or it just came together. Sometimes I look back and I say, oops, where am I? How did it happen? That's some question. But it's a sort of it's like an addiction that you move forwards, and the more you work with people and the more project you have, the more you want to explore, the more you want to reach out to other people, other collaborators, new students, and it's quite natural.
Gotcha. No, that's a great answer. So let's talk about, we've actually mentioned this word a couple of times now, and I want to pick your brain about it. We've talked about convergence and we've talked about it in a couple of different contexts, but I want to talk about it in the context of computing because that is a big kind of movement that's going on now with this convergence of cloud and high performance computing. Can we step back and tell our listeners how you would define convergence in this space and then talk about some of the important ideas or work that are happening right now?
Well, there is every person you ask have a different definition for convergence of HPC and cloud. For me, it is about having a access to both based on what I need. And that access come with common API and interfaces that allow me to, as a scientist who is developing and running application for scientific discovery, it becomes some sort of seamless environment. But then I don't have to think about, oh my goodness, do I need to choose the resources? Do I need to am I running out of resources? Do I have concern about my job failing? The point of convergence is having a unified API that allow me and take care of me as a scientist to reach out to resources that can be hybrid cloud, HPC, and the convergence is means accessibility to this without me rewriting my application, without me learning a new resource management tool, without me dealing with all the problem that one specific type of platform can have. Now, this is the abstraction. What it's needed is more people that help us to build us this API because we cannot afford to ask scientists to rewrite their applications. We cannot afford scientists to say, pay me for this amount of resources because I put you on the cloud, or pay me this amount of resources because you want back your data. That is something that we need to address and resolve through APIs and through the seamless interface.
So you said two things that kind of stuck out to me. The first is accessibility, and there's a lot of questions to unwrap with that. And then the second thing that kind of comes out of what you said is that a lot of this comes down to scheduling and workload managers and orchestration, because that is at the end of the day, when you're sitting on a command line somewhere, or you're in a web interface somewhere, and you have a piece of work to run, and you need to have it run to somewhere, wherever, whether that be HPC or cloud, or it's decided when you click a button, that's kind of the component that needs to be worked on. And so, to kind of bring in some of our collaboration, we look at these two different spaces and we say, okay, well, Kubernetes is this de facto orchestrator for cloud. Granted, we have different clouds that have different, very different APIs, and it would be hard to write that single cohesive API to rule them all. We have this common interface that is Kubernetes. So that's really great. And so then we can look on the side of HPC and we can also look at workload managers. And we don't have to choose a specific one, but you could imagine that an HPC workload manager could be integrated with Kubernetes. And
Well,
so do you think?
Flux is a powerful resource manager scheduler that integrated with Kubernetes can provide, is a key component of this API or this interface. And I feel that that is the direction to go, investing in
Gotcha.
this. The other part that it's important is containerization. And now everybody speak about containers, but probably 10 years ago, very few were speaking about containers because they were still the stigma of being too expensive, too hard to manage. But if we look now at container technology like Singularity slash Aptina, they are so powerful, but we need still to keep make them even more powerful. We can deploy them at the level of different type of platforms that can go from HPC to hybrid cloud to a cloud. They allow us also to create aspect of traceability and provenance. So come to my mind the work that one of my students who just graduated, Paula Olaja, did, in which she leveraged Aptainers to create containerization not only of application but also of data, and able to leverage them to work across hybrid clouds and HPC, and at the same time trace what is the transformation of the data from container to container when you build this complex workflow, and understand reason on why we get some results rather than other. Supporting also aspect of reasoning on black boxes, otherwise considered black boxes like AI. So technology that are very appealing nowadays, yes, is Kubernetes, Flux, Aptainers. These are exciting technology that allow us to move towards a fully executed convergency.
I totally agree. And I would add that a lot of the rootless modes for sort of the container technologies that traditionally we wouldn't run on HPC are getting a lot better. Not to say that you would have, Docker running on an HPC system, but it's very common these days to see Podman, for example, running in some contexts on different HPC systems. And Podman, in its design, it doesn't use the SIF, a single layer. It uses, a standard Docker design with chargz layers that are decompressed. But it's more similar to what we traditionally think of as Docker. And I was thinking back, I was like, 10 years, no one was thinking about containers. And I was like, was I thinking about containers? And I suddenly felt very old because I was definitely using and thinking about containers 10 years ago, although I didn't start working on Singularity until 9 years ago. So wasn't thinking about Singularity yet. So one interesting thing that I'm hearing, it sounds like we have a lot. If you think of us as being like, I don't know, pastry chefs or regular chefs, whichever you prefer, it seems like we have a lot of the ingredients that we need. We have our kind of orchestrators on different sides. We have also actually, we actually do have workflow tools. They just kind of need a little more love. And we have container technologies. And it's really kind of up to us to be writing and figuring out the recipes that taste best, where taste best means that it's actually the best experience for the scientific user. But when you look at that simple task, I think this is where the cultural kind of challenges come in. So, at face value, you need people, you need bodies and brains and, fingers to hit the keyboard to work on these things. And if you compare like our developer community in HPC versus the developer community at like, I don't know, at a big tech company, they're very different sizes. And so let me turn this into a useful question. When you look at the cultural differences between the HPC community and the cloud community, and the need to both work on these integrations, but also work together, what are the biggest issues that you see?
Well, there is an aspect of trust, or perhaps an aspect of not everybody understand that we cannot work in silos, that we will not win this battle, or we will not deliver the perfect cake with the ingredient we have if we don't work together. And so I think that there is still a lot of compartmental work at the level of HPC that look at HPC in the old fashion. I think that there is a little bit of not arrogance, but naive approach from big tech that don't understand the importance of working with academia, with labs on these aspects. Because at the end of the day, we are creating a pipeline of talents. And the talents start in school, and then some of this talented colleague stay in academia because of the freedom, because of the creativity that doesn't have the boundary that otherwise you may find in industry. But we need to come together. And there has been a lot of initiatives, there is a lot of opportunity that are emerging. Last year, for example, there was a fantastic panel at SC speaking about HPC and cloud convergence, in which colleagues from industry, lab, academia came together. And there was a recent paper that was published in the IEEE Computer Magazine summarizing that discussion. But it's still too little, and we need to invest more. And we need also to be a little bit patient, you know, especially when it is about technology that have different paces. We need to be patient to each other in terms of community and understand where to use what. So I would say more investment in communication, more investment in events that bring us together to discuss, more investment in training the talents. And don't steal the student who are in the middle of their master of PhD. Let them finish, because there is where stealing meant a colleague in industry. Because that happens all the time. Because there is where there is an opportunity to work together and also train this talented next generation of expert so that they are open to both community. Does it make sense?
Yeah, you mean the national labs and academic centers aren't just a recruiting ground for the tech company? Like, did I have that wrong? No,
Yes, but
you're totally right. I've had so many people on my
you need
core
to
team
keep, yes.
hired away.
No, but you need to keep a healthy pipeline. If you come and you steal the talent too early, if you steal all of them, or you make for us hard to recruit them and nourish them and train them, eventually you dry the tree that generate this talent. You dry and you kill that tree. So there have to be an healthy collaboration in which industry participate in the academic research and let students finish their master, their PhD, and then recruit them. Or let some of them become an academic. There have to be an equilibrium in the process of who goes where. And in some circumstances, this equilibrium is compromised because there is this aggressive recruitment of students. And then you don't see on a long term that in 5 years you will not have the person with the training in being a group leader because you didn't allow that person to mature to that level. And so it's a short-term investment, recruiting and taking students away from their graduate school
The
or
nest to make them fly too early from the nest, and then
exactly.
the nest is empty, and the mama bird, the metaphor you made with like the tree dying, that I don't know why it hit me like really hard, like to see this
Yes.
little tree just like dying. I was like, oh.
Anyway, sorry, we are speaking about recruitment and retention of students in graduate school, which is an important thing, and it's a challenging situation for many in academia. And so I
Totally
wish that
agree.
students that have the courage to stay in graduate school, finish their master, finish their PhD, while being engaged in collaboration with industry, with national labs, and build the maturity that you be can become an independent researcher and you don't answer to task, but you answer to question, or you raise those questions. And because you empower yourself through the training, through the PhD work, through the master work, to the participation in conferences. It's a playground where you can become an independent researcher, graduate school. And it's fun. It's really
Oh,
fun
yeah.
with students. My best time of my life being a graduate student. I had really fantastic colleagues, incredible opportunities, and I was without the responsibility of ensuring funding, ensuring, that at the end of the day, the budget is balanced. So it's a great opportunity to develop curiosity without thinking, oh my goodness, do I have the funding?
Absolutely agree. So, to go back to this idea of working together, one challenge in that space has to do with incentives. So, we do have this common infrastructure and desire to, work on kind of modular, reproducible workflows with containers and the like. But when you look at the incentive structure, it's very different. So, right now, of course, in tech companies, it's all about AI and machine learning and workloads and getting that running. And development is going toward that mindset. For example, looking at the precision of chips, that is being changed that in a direction that is more for AI, probably less for, sciences, so like climate sciences and et cetera. So given that we have very different incentive structures, and this is something we joke about a lot. We say, ha ha, the future cloud is not going to be good for science at all. Like, oh well, I guess our jobs are done. How do you manage that conflict today and now to make sure that we have a voice, we as scientists have a voice that say our science is important. This technology that you haven't looked at, so like NPI, for example, that is the bread and butter of HPC, it needs to work in cloud too. What are strategies for making sure that that voice is not lost?
Well, I think that it is more an education rather than a strategy to train and educate colleagues who don't appreciate or don't understand or don't know about the impact of HPC and computer system. Because if you think about what AI was when I was a PhD student, it was very much theoretical because there were not the infrastructure. And what generated those infrastructure? Computer system, HPC, the cloud are creating those infrastructure. But now we have another, every time you address a bottleneck, you have a next one. So now good luck training neural network and LLM if you don't have big infrastructure, big computers. But then keep in mind that training is really consuming a lot of energy. It's so all this awareness of nobody can live on an island alone, and especially the AI people cannot, because they need infrastructure, they need power in terms of power consumption, and they need efficient software stack and efficient computer systems that mitigate the need for energy, that use resources efficiently. So there is a need for education across community of the role of each other.
Have you found that being a lead for different conferences is a good position to be in to provide that kind of education and visibility?
I try. I try. It's and discussions like this one, discussion on panels, conversation with colleague in other domains. Every single step counts, but we need more people doing sort of be go out and disseminate the good story, the roles of others. It's an effort that need more people joining.
So in the next, let's say, year, what are you most excited about that's coming up?
My sabbatical.
Oh, excellent. Actually, okay, so I know that academics take sabbaticals. Can you tell me about what it means to take a sabbatical, like leading up to it, what you do on your sabbatical? I mean, I
Well,
imagine it's just like a really great vacation, but when I really think about it, I've never actually thought about what people do on a sabbatical.
I really want to work more closely with national labs because I think it's very important that the academic world and national lab work together. And so I will spend some time at Lawrence Livermore. I'm finalizing my starting date. I want to look also at the level international, looking into opportunity to look at what are considered national labs, for example, in Japan, like RIKEN. I would like to not only collaborate, but also full immersion, live the life in a national lab, the daily life, to understand the challenges, understand the opportunity, expand the opportunity, and so, and perhaps create more connection between academia and national labs, because by joining our forces, we can indeed contribute to the awareness for convergence and also the use of convergent HPC cloud system for scientific discovery. So I will invest my next year into exploring, strengthening collaboration with the lab by visiting them, starting with the Lawrence Livermore National Lab.
That's awesome. I don't know if our groups know that, but that is super exciting. Our listeners probably know I work at Lawrence Livermore National Lab, although I have never physically been there. I'm a remote employee. So Michaela, I think you're going to beat me to that. But yeah, I'm really excited for that whenever it happens to start. So we are coming up on time. I'm going to ask just a few more questions. So speaking of sabbaticals, I guess I was thinking a sabbatical is taking time off, but when you do take time off, which I'm sure is probably quite rare, when you're relaxing, what do you like to do for fun?
I listen a lot of podcasts. I love podcasts, the most diverse, from history to politics to sciences. And I take care of my my dog, my husband, friends, and then I think about the next question in science that fascinates me.
Okay, so first tell me some of your favorite podcasts because I also love podcasts. I think I've been listening to them pretty heavily since maybe 2008 or 2009 when, the first kind of popular ones came out like Radiolab and that kind of thing.
Well, there are many, many. I like a lot the BBC podcast. I like Fresh Air. There is the Enquirer from BBC. I like this idea of structuring podcasts through question and answer. It's a little bit of everything, and I feel like I'm not don't give any. I'm missing to give credit to many that I'm listening to. Economics, I love it. It's American Life.
Oh yeah. Freakonomics and This American Life have been on my since like 2008 or 2009 list. I absolutely love them.
I like the New Yorker when there are discussion with writers that speak about their books, and that's really fascinating. Many, many. And it's the point is that every time I go in, I look for a new one, and I am always finding something interesting.
Absolutely. And what you said about when you're kind of relaxing or having fun and then like an idea trickles in, I can totally relate to that. So when I relax, I'll go for like a run or I'll go for a bike ride. And for a while, my mind can wander and think about, other things, but always inadvertently that, the idea, the previous thinking of like what I'm working on or, this idea that I haven't, fully thought through yet, like it comes into my consciousness and it starts to take over. And then I realize that I'm on my bike ride and I'm thinking about Kubernetes again. And it's like, no.
Indeed, indeed, it's following us because it's part of it's we are very fortunate. Our work it's almost a hobby with challenges.
Yeah. Hobby slash obsession slash, somewhere in there.
Addiction.
Yeah, exactly. It's a good addiction when you get paid for it. So, no complaints here. Okay, last question. If you could go back in time, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Oh my goodness. I don't know. This is a difficult question. Perhaps I would advise myself to take more time to do things like coding or focusing on aspect of implementation, because I feel I grew up very fast, and in growing up, the responsibility changes. And I ended up right now, I don't code any longer, Vanessa. I write proposal, I write papers, I work with students and brainstorm, but at the end of the day, the 24 hours are not sufficient. And I feel that I really rushed through this process, and perhaps I would have taken a little bit more time doing things that I build my career on, but don't have any longer space in my daily work because of other commitments. And so one of them is coding.
Oh, maybe on your sabbatical you could have some time for coding.
It will be 150% job because my group is still here. And so
Right.
they have my attention and my support, and they move forward successful. You know, sabbatical doesn't mean freezing time, that you take the group and say, everybody stop, don't move, don't think, wait for me for
You mean you
300.
can't freeze time? Because I was
Yeah, so we wait for 12 months, I come back in 12 months, and then we start
Everyone's
again.
like in the same position. You just like click a button, unfreeze. Someone falls over, drops like soda on their lap. Like, what just happened? Oh, nothing. Just continue on.
So the alternative is having a double life or two careers and make sure that both move forward successfully.
Well, if you ever go into the future and you aren't leading a lab and you want to get back into programming, I can definitely offer up hackathons, and programming is still one of my favorite things. So, please ask me for help, whatever.
When I retire, I will start coding again.
Right. When you retire. Alrighty, Michaela, it has been super fun chatting with you, and I'm very excited to hear that you're going to be spending more time with us at the lab. And thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Thank you, Vanessa, and see you soon. Bye, everyone.